What the hell are we talking about?
So I'm going to spring it on you. It's a little bit vague, but bear with me. Recently, Marco Arment had a piece about Apple potentially missing out on the machine learning AI side of things. And services seems to be keep coming up. Certainly, Apple as a company keeps talking it up. I don't want to talk about that so much as what was on my mind to ask you guys about was you've both been in various organizations that have needed to sort of change direction. What does that look like from the inside, and how do you facilitate that? And kind of what are the frictions about? Like, for example, Don, at Netscape, you guys went open source.
Yes.
Kind of a big change. Yes. You know, and at Apple, you got the web religion, yes, for lack of a better word, you know?
And the performance religion.
And went to OS X.
There's a, yes. This is why I kind of want to talk about it at a meta level rather than... First of all, I think it's unfair to address specifics that we're either unaware of, or I just don't think it's fair to call people out, structurally, I think there's an interesting conversation to be had about changing direction, because needing certainly iOS or iPhone OS did that too inside the company.
Oh, well, the iPhone project was a complete change of direction. But let's back up to the bigger thing, so I can rant about all this talk about Apple and, you know, it having to do something new.
Okay, what I'm really not trying to put either of you on the hook for the ranting or anything. I just wanted to, I'm trying to set the stage about.
Can I just hear Don say calm the fuck down, please?
Yeah, yes. Everybody needs to calm the fuck down.
Or motherfucker, I can. Either one is his choice.
Either one. So and I have patents pending on those. The whole thing, everybody's like so worried about Apple, and it's like, why? You know, I'm not seeing that same thing. The problems that I see with Apple are not the, some of them are what people see on the outside, but not this thing. That's not the, I have never worried about Apple being willing to eat itself to do the next thing, or to make the hard calls, or to come up with another technology, or it's just, they've constantly done that kind of thing. So that's, you know, it's in the DNA of all the people and all the people that are still there. The problem that I see with Apple has now is that it's just a problem of companies that grow large. They're doing too many things, and I think right now, you know, just a few too many plates in the air. And so I'm less concerned about them doing yet again another big thing and trying to get, you know, the software right, because I have not been happy this year, even though Apple has supposedly been focusing on making things more stable. You all heard the story about me having to text Craig Federighi so I could get my wife's, you know, goddamn iPad unbricked from a software update. And I was just about to update to new iOS when I found out that Apple... Then Apple pulled the update again.
And so 9.3.2 to the iPad.
Yeah.
9.7.
Yeah.
So I'm not sitting around worried about that Apple is missing out on machine learning or they're missing out on this. What I'm worried about is that they're not getting the polish in there because they're actually focusing on too much new stuff. That's also a problem. So there's my rant. Neaton, you want to argue with me or add anything to that? Or sorry.
No, I think that's perfectly valid, and I agree. I agree completely. The problem that I have with sort of evaluating AI as something that Apple needs to go whole hog in right now is, I mean, that, so there are a couple of problems. One of them is, and I'm sorry, Guy, this is probably not at all what you wanted to talk about.
No, that's okay. I didn't want to make you guys talk about this, but since you just won't stop, go for it.
Well, so the couple of problems that I see with that are that, you know, I haven't seen anybody really demonstrate that there's a way to build a successful business using the product of AI other than advertising companies. And so, Apple has certainly, shown that they're more, they're all about selling shiny boxes, right? They've always sold shiny boxes, and they will, and that's so ingrained that, that selling advertising is just this alien thing. And so as long as the only demonstrable way to make money continues to be to produce better ads or better targeted ads, if that's the only benefit of going whole hog on AI, then fuck AI, as far as Apple is concerned. I'm waiting to see when products actually get markedly better from the use of AI. And I would love to hear you guys now embarrass me with, an obvious example of a place where AI is making huge advances outside of advertising.
The point is voice recognition with AI, and Apple hasn't stepped up their game with Siri. And the thing is, I always kind of remind people, like, you're not inside infinite loop. You're not in the box in Cupertino. You don't know what the Siri team is doing. So, shut the fuck up. they didn't fire everybody. There's a couple of original guys who left, but that's still a huge team. I know a lot of people are working on it, and they're not sitting on their hands. I mean, they're not stupid. They're not navel gazing.
Well, it's also possible that they have quite a lot of machine learning going on there, going back to Siri's origins, and have offices that do a lot of that, which is why they can offer that service in multiple countries, in multiple languages, and now simultaneous languages at the same time, which most of their competitors can't do.
Right, exactly. And the thing is we all know that they're working on a car. I mean, whether that actually ever sees the light of day, but if you've got if you're going to think that there's going to be autonomous car, if they're heading that direction, they're probably going the machine learning route about that.
I want to underscore a point that Neaton made, which I thought was brilliant, was everybody's worried about Apple missing out. And I hadn't really thought about missing out on what. And he's right. It's like what? Like an advertising game?
Yeah, yeah.
Which is kind of not their play, So I thought that was astute, and I just want to call it out in particular because, stories that Apple is trailing and behind in this area may or may not prove to be true, but what is the value of the area?
Absolutely. I mean, that's the thing is, in this industry especially, and I'm sure other industries go through this too, but there's always the next new shiny thing. Right. And if you go chasing every single one of them, you're going to go broke and you're going to have a bunch of half-assed products along the way. Or maybe you won't have any products at all. But you were so busy chasing what this pundit said or that blogger wrote or this other person, some analyst said, that, you really have to at some point step back. And I think that Apple management, the Apple executive team, has been great at this. And frankly, I learned so much just by observing, sort of the thought process that went on there. But I think that, they're really, they're really stepping back. If things are running now the way I imagine, a version of the way they were a couple of years ago when I was there, I'm sure people are standing back and saying, okay, that's great, but what's in it for us? Where's the benefit to either any of our platforms? How do we make our product better? And Don, you brought up a great example of voice recognition and actually making, using machine learning, as a way to make voice recognition and therefore Siri a much more compelling product than it is now. But beyond that, what's in it for us? And why should we go and chase this thing just because somebody wrote that they're worried that we're going to be the next, last failed company? I mean, it's a great way to get people's attention by writing those things. And, and Syracuse did it a couple of years ago by saying such and such as Apple's Copeland, all you have to do is throw Apple in a headline and failed company or failed product in the headline.
Yeah. And to be fair to Syracuse and Marco, they're not doing it in order to get attention.
And thank you for saying that. And I absolutely completely agree with that. I completely agree with that. And I think that what they're doing is far more thoughtful and it just so happened that they used a similar pattern to people who aren't as well written.
Yeah, I'm behind you in your rant. I just don't want them to be.
I'm not. I'm not singling them out either. I read Marco's piece and I wasn't like offended by it or anything else like that. To be perfectly honest, I've had my head down out of the news. Because frankly, even if you try to look just at tech news these days, it's hard to avoid the boorish quaff of Donald Trump inching its way from the side of the pitch. And
we have the guest room ready, Don.
Yeah. So I don't need that shit. So I have my own little projects and diversions right now. In terms of the issues that Apple is dealing with right now, they're dealing with some organizational issues in terms of how to keep the good stuff good, how to keep the vertical organization going as long as they can, and not break it up, which I've heard a lot of people say that Apple's going to die if they don't get rid of this functional organization. Asshats. Or Apple's not going to die if they don't get into this. It's like, please, it's just easy to write this shit because
To Neaton's point, it's like there's a formula to what the headline is, right? Yeah. Apple verb, something doom.
And to my point, my little rant about, let's make sure we're up to quality and everything else and keeping customers happy. For all my little rants, Apple is still very highly regarded. And frankly, after diving down into another set of devices recently that are not Apple devices, which I don't want to go into in depth, I was like, oh shit, boy, this is what the rest of the world is like, isn't it? So I was like, I guess, that's why, I write those letters every week to Craig and Darren and others, and I just delete them before I send them.
Oh, bless you for deleting them.
Yeah. I did break down and text him that night, and I must say for Craig, he was a gem and responded within it was like less than a minute, and I must have got him during the dinner hour, so.
That's super nice of him. You don't even work for him anymore. Like, he has no reason to be nice to you.
Yeah. So he and the head of QA, Josh. You're Josh. Josh called me on the phone because if you can get some Josh time, you can solve the problem.
Totally play the Gramps card.
So at the end of this episode, we're gonna raffle off Craig Federici's home phone number.
No.
Proceeds go to charity. Thanks, Craig, for participating in this. That's really nice.
I'm sure Neaton's got the number too. So.
You get to drop off your computer at his house one time.
At the end of the day, they're really nice people and they know what the hell they're doing. So I'm not worried about them. I still have a lot of stock. I haven't sold it yet.
Well, and I think that you also brought up another point earlier, which was a good one, that Apple has been through these types of transitions so many times that it's already part of part of their DNA to always be changing and recognizing when things aren't going well, rallying the entire company behind the new effort, and so
yeah, you, that, you know that,
it's, that was... does anybody remember Mark Lahr? I mean, I was there. That one.
Well, how about PowerPC? How about the Mac OS to OS 10 transition? Yeah. I mean, those were, and then yes, of course, Mark Lahr and
iOS. It's the Intel transition for people,
right?
Yeah,
following along at home.
Right.
Yeah. But yeah, no. So this is the kind of meta stuff.
You had the bingo card, and Marklar was over in that bottom left corner, score. So anyway, but that what a great transition to the thing you really want us to talk about, right, Guy?
Well, I'm smart. I knew we'd get there. But yeah, no, this is exactly it. Big ships take a bit of time to move. I know that you've both been through huge transitions, and Apple is remarkably good at doing it. What are the commonalities and patterns that you see? And is it getting harder over time, or is it always just, I don't know, get behind the current push as hard as you can?
Well, there's always that, but part of it is the motivation. You know, you mentioned at Netscape. I mean, it was a different motivation at Netscape. It was really fear. I mean, because we were not going to have a business if we did something. We were watching the boot heel of Microsoft come down and start to grind.
Yeah, they really stuck it to you. From a historical perspective, they released IE for free and bundled it with Windows.
Right. And so if anybody thinks that open source was a brilliant, long thought out move, full of shit, it was a Hail Mary play. So part of it depends on the motivation why you go down that path of change. That was one that was motivated by, as they say, existential threat. Right. So, it's different. In the case of, let's take the case that I had the front row seat at Apple for at least two of those. Neaton has the front row seat at Apple many more than I do because he was there longer. But for Marklar, in a sense, that was an existential threat as well, but not the same kind of thing. It was just that.
Because IBM was stalling out and providing performance.
Well, Motorola was incompetent, right? So,
yeah.
The chips were
the G5 stalled out basically.
Yeah. Yeah. The G5 stalled out and do you even remember what the next chip was supposed to be called that we didn't use after the G5? I can't even remember what it was supposed to be called.
Oh God. I don't remember either. Maybe it'll come to me, but yeah, I'll blurt it out. But
yeah, blurt it just. IBM's
game plan at the time was to take their Power series, so Power 5, and then chop it down to be more of a consumer-oriented chip. But they could never get the G5 into a mobile form factor.
No.
Because it's a little bit hot, by which I mean very, very, very dangerously hot. So, yeah.
Like China syndrome hot.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was. It wasn't just hot. It was, it was a... media broadcasting station. There was a lot of RF coming from those chips once that you wound them up. They were very, very noisy that way.
Oh, I didn't even thought of that. That's interesting.
But getting to that situation, so there was partly an existential threat. We had to do something. That was a motivation, but it was less about that and more about, well, this sucks. Just dissatisfaction. We couldn't do some of the things that we wanted to do. And it wasn't just the CPU was a dog. The support chip story, the infrastructure, the whole, it's a word I'm trying to think of. I don't want to say DC. Environment, the economy, that whole chip economy really wasn't working out for us. And so we had to do something. And it wasn't done... For example, at Netscape, when I was there, the decision to go open source was something that happened in like less than 24 hours, I swear.
Wow.
Like overnight, practically. And we could do a whole separate podcast sometime on that whole thing and the emails back and forth, because I happen to be in management and was amusing and scary. Anyway,
so you guys already had WebKit spun up on Intel, right?
Well, when Marklar came around?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, wait. Well, it was cooking before you got there?
Well, they were thinking about Marklar about the same time as I arrived at Apple. because that was in 2001. So, Neaton, when was the first time you heard about Marklar? Was it 2002?
It was probably not even two for me, honestly. What probably wasn't even 2002. I bet it was around 2000. It was in 2003.
2003. Oh, okay.
Was probably around the time that that I had heard about it, and that
you were on Henri's team at the time, right?
Yes. Yeah, exactly. So, I was managing the mail team at the time.
Right. So mail didn't get the goodness right away, but I didn't hear about it until very late 2001, because we didn't actually see it in action until I don't think I saw it in action until sometime in the spring of 2002, and that's when they came to me that summer of 2002 and said, well, can you put Safari on it or Alexander on it? Mm-hmm. Cause we had Alexander up and running by that summer. And I was like, seriously, we're really going to do this. And I thought, cool, and I scratched my head and I thought, well, how hard can this be? Right. Cause I guess they had terminal on it already.
So perfect.
pretty much done then.
And what I didn't realize is they came to me because I was like stupid enough to do the web browser project anyway, and they needed a mark, right? Somebody who would like fall for it and say, oh, sure. And so I wasted an engineer on it, and because the core code was all cross-platform anyway. And other people were doing the hard work of doing, marshaling data and worrying about byte orders and all that other shit. So the core code was already cross-platform because it ran on Linux, right? And so I went, yeah, what the hell? You know, it's just a make file, right?
Well, Conqueror, right? What was the KHTML was the basis of WebKit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
it had come from an Intel world in the first place.
And there wasn't, and I'm, you know, as I'm having the conversation with Scott Forslow about this, and I forget who else it was. Shit. I was running the code up and down in the back of my eyes, thinking, where in the code is something stupid and dependent on that? And I didn't see anything. And I went, okay, we can give it a shot. And they were like, yes, we found somebody stupid. And so a couple of months later, we actually had it. We had it working on Marklar. It was the first big app. And what I didn't know is then for everybody that they wanted to reveal Safari to, starting the summer of 2002, because they wouldn't show it to anybody because they didn't want to know about Safari. What they would say instead is, "We have this really big app that's already ported. Why aren't you guys porting? Why aren't you guys starting?" And so for the people who already disclosed, they said, well, Safari's, Alexander's already there. So you need to get to work on this. And
if Don can do it, you can.
I'd never heard Alexander before, but thanks.
Oh, yeah. That's what the code name was.
You're like leaking like 15 years later, but that's fine. Yeah.
I wrote about that.
That glazed over it then.
Yeah. And so you were drunk. The
Osmandius was the Gecko project that Don decided not to go well along with.
Yeah, there you go. So so when did you guys start working on mail? It was 2003 early, right?
It was 2003, and it was sort of the time that, these random beige boxes started showing up around in people's offices. I'm sure you remember those. Yep. It was, it was pretty easy to see because everybody had these nice silver boxes, for their Macs at the time. And what the hell is that awful looking beige thing that, looks like it was made in 1998. It was exactly that. And I had one engineer who was working, he wasn't working full time on it, but it was sort of the latest build has come out and it, we found these problems and we need somebody to go in and tweak a few things. It was never that big of an effort for mail either. And I'm guessing it was just because you know, Mail had come from OpenStep as well,
which was on Intel,
which was already on Intel as well.
Yeah,
so.
you guys were one of the easy ones to go on. If I recall, do you remember which one was hard? Because I know they had a desktop app up, but it wasn't Finder. It was actually the old, it was a modified version of the old OpenStep desktop app that they were running us all in. Yeah,
Workspace is what they were calling it.
Workspace or something like that. Because the Finder team had, if I recall correctly, had a hard time getting onto Marklar just because they were very.
Well, I had to guess. That, I mean, that's the most powered PC. I mean, what? It took, well, Neaton knows this, what, 8.5 before everything got to powered PC?
Yeah, yeah. Well, and even on 8.5, it was everything. You know, not everything was PowerPC.
Yeah, I think QuickDraw moved to 8.5. Moved over on 8.5.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. A lot of the higher level frameworks and libraries had moved over by 8.5. That's true. And so yeah, the Finder. I think the Finder was first PowerPC native in 8.0. You know, when it was the new, you know, remember the multi-threaded Finder?
Yeah.
And we went Chrome. It got the, or do they call it Chrome?
Yeah, the new, well,
Platinum.
The new
Platinum.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Had the new look and everything. And so, yeah, that was, from what I recall, that was the first, you know, just sort of all native Finder with all native, higher level, frameworks and libraries and things like that. But there was still this damn emulator underneath and lots of core parts of Mac OS that still required the emulator, oddly enough.
And it was Christly scary too. So, from your unique perspective, cause I was talking about the vast differences in starting out or reasons for, you know, Netscape, going open source and us starting Marklar at Apple. Did you see a similarity between the PowerPC to Intel, not PowerPC to Intel, the Mac OS 9 to Mac OS 10 transition? Because you watched that firsthand.
Yeah, that one was a lot more.
You were working
with
John back then, right? Weren't you?
Well, originally I was working on the sort of the last of the system software team. So I was working on the group that it was actually shipping Mac OS 7.5 and 7.6 and you know 8.0. We were, you know, we sort of joked that we were the software group that was keeping the lights on because we were the ones who were working on system software that actually shipped on Macintoshes and
Keith was running was sort of like the head technical geek of, was it 8 or was it not?
Of 9. Of 9.0, he was the head tech guy. Yeah, sure.
Who ran 8?
It was, I mean, I think it was still, it might have been Darren Litzinger.
Oh, yeah.
I think it might have been Darren at that time who was still running things. But, yeah, but, you know, it was, so I think you touched on something that I think was oddly a benefit as far as the you know for the purposes of a transition goes, which is that for you know at least for the OS 9 you know the classic Mac OS to Mac OS 10 transition and there were you know hints of it too during the 68K to PowerPC transition, but it was really that Apple was going out of business. You know, mm-hmm. Apple was, there was, now it really wasn't obvious in for the 68K to PowerPC. That was really more of a, we can't build competitive hardware anymore, right? And that one.
Right. It was less about going out of business or that this is technology that's a dead end.
Exactly.
And it wasn't because we have to change like tomorrow or die. You know, we have to. Yeah.
Yeah. In hindsight, I feel like the Mac, go ahead.
No, please, Neaton, go.
I was going to say whereas the classic Mac OS to OS 10 transition, I think that coincided with the company, you know, being at close to book value, right, as far as the stock goes. And there were
bought a lot of stock back then too.
When your CEO is standing in front of you and saying that, you know, that we're going to go out of business and we have to make these transitions and we have to make them successful. that can be pretty motivating. And you know, I think the other, that's in combination. I think there are two things, right? First of all, it was all over the news and it was everywhere. You know, I think somebody just recently posted on Twitter the, you know, there was a Time magazine cover that had the Apple icon and it said the death of an American icon. Mm-hmm. And I think that was in 1996, right? So that was a year or two before, you know, before the next acquisition and the big transition started. But already, if you were working at Apple, you were kind of feeling like, you know, hey, this place is not what it used to be, and it may not be around for very long. And so, you know, when you're faced with that, and your CEO, your brand new CEO, comes, you know, walks up on stage and starts talking about the same things, you know, talking about how there is, I mean, there was very literally an existential threat at that time,
yeah,
of going out of business. You know, I think that all of those things can be motivating. And by the way, the audience was the right audience to hear it, which is to say that the employees who were left working at Apple were the ones who sort of believed in the cause. You know, they were the ones who, and maybe this is overly favorable of you know, myself and people who were still there, but you kind of had to be a little crazy to say.
No, you're completely right. I think all of you were very saintly for sticking around and also crazy. Just let me add
bleeding in six colors.
I mean, I had friends left and right going to startups, right, and talking about how, you know, the you know, all the benefits to going, and you're, hey, and also you're not working at a dying company. Wouldn't that be cool? You know, and so you hear all these things, and then, you know, and at the same time, you start to understand what the marching orders are for this big transition that you need to make. And you understand that the things that you have been doing up until then have gotten you into this mess that you're in right now.
Mm-hmm. So
it's our own fault. Right. So there's nowhere to go. But OK, well, you either leave, which you probably already would have left by then anyway. You know, if it's not like you were going to hear the CEO and say, that's it, I'm out of here. Well, actually, and I'll get back to that in a second. But but the audience is, you know, is receptive to that type of thing. And at those moments, in my mind, I think that it's advantageous to be going out of business if you need to have such a change in culture and a change in attitude, then going out of business is actually going to be beneficial to you. Probably the worst thing that could happen is what happened to BlackBerry, which is they posted record profits, or record revenues or whatever those numbers were in the year that the iPhone came out, right? And they were still posting profits for a couple of years after that. And so, you know, if you're looking at that and if you're part of the executive team and, you know, and I can only imagine, you know, you're a little bit cold because you're in Waterloo and, you know, I don't know what goes on in people's minds, but anyway, you know, you look at this hard.
You don't get the feeling of the threat nearly as much. You don't take it as seriously. Right.
You don't have to take it as seriously because you can afford to, you know, you're doing better than you ever have. And there's this little project that's come along and maybe people have been telling you, you know, all along that something is going to eat your lunch. And now this other thing is going to come and eat your lunch. And now this other thing. And now, you know, the last thing that happened to come along is this thing called the iPhone. And yet you're just kicking butt. And you've been hearing about these things for so many years that after a while you stop believing that, well, okay, yeah, Windows Phone, that's been out for a couple of years now. We're doing just fine. You know what? You start to believe that nobody's going to put you out of business, right?
So isn't that hubris what people are kind of taking Apple to task for now? I don't necessarily know if it's warranted, but I kind of appreciate that people are at least presenting that as a possibility.
I don't think it's quite the same thing. I mean, in context with what particular project? See, the thing is, people are projecting they're projecting all these other things on Apple, and they don't know really what's going on inside or what the other projects are. And, you know, Nina and I have both worked there long enough. I mean, we're not going to talk about this stuff, but we've got some pretty good goddamn guesses as to what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just it's not that people are whispering behind a door to us. It's not like that at all. I had lunch with a friend of mine a couple of weeks ago, and he wanted to show me something on his phone. And I said, you can't show me the picture of your kids on your phone. And he said, why? I said, you're running the new OS, dumbass. And he was like, oh yeah, you don't work there anymore. So I don't let people tell me, but I work there long enough that I can make some pretty good goddamn guesses. And so what people are projecting onto Apple are things that I don't think are entirely valid.
Well, I think the concern is that kind of hubris took out the phone makers, effectively, smartphone makers. Why can that not apply to Apple?
Oh,
from the outside, it's like, well, I mean, they're making money hand over fist, except this last one, which, whatever, get over it. Stop that. It's a blip. But yeah, blip. By and large, they're in the same position that BlackBerry's in, was in.
There are two issues.
To at least critique them along those lines?
Yeah.
Sure, if it sells papers.
I mean, just intellectually fair.
I don't know. There are two issues there. One is that you're assuming that you know what the next big thing is. And this goes to Neaton's point, his first rant.
Yeah,
that is. And the second one, again, to my rant, is it's everybody making the assumption that Apple isn't doing anything. Apple doesn't tell you what they're working on. They just don't do that. It's just the way they work. And a lot of times they do work on things that never see the light of day either.
Because
they decide that's just not good enough, or that's not the kind of business we want to do, or we're going to do it again. You know, you get to try it again. So I think what you have to judge a company on is what it actually produces, and not what you think it should be doing at that time. That's a really stupid thing to do.
That's fair. It's also the stock market.
You wouldn't do that to another human being, right?
No.
Right. We should be judged on our actions. So, and I think the criticisms that Apple's had with its first venture into a wearable computing and the watch, those are valid criticisms. I think there are very good things about that device, and I think there are some things where they missed the user experience on that. But it's also like they're not just going to sit on their hands, because that would mean one of them would have the watch on it. but they're going to iterate on that too. And it's like it's the same thing I was talking about with Siri. It's the same thing I was talking about with the automotive projects. I'm sure. Here's my prediction: by the end of the year, somebody's going to get a hair up their ass because they've written themselves to death about all this other stuff, and they're not getting enough clicks. And somebody's going to start writing about the fact that OS X and iOS are end of life, and Apple better do something right away to rewrite the OS. Or has that already happened? Because I usually ignore that.
I wrote that twice last week, Don.
Oh, okay. So this is the way it works. This is the kind of shit that drives me crazy. Okay, let's get back to the original part of the discussion. I was going to make a point where Neaton was going really good on, the impetus, which it was not existential threat with a name like we were at Netscape, Microsoft, but it was more like existential threat with the entire industry moving over to the new OS. And it goes to motivations, but let's take a look at the start of the iPhone, which was a completely different thing inside of Apple, right? Mm-hmm. Whole new direction for the company, or at least a small part of it from the very beginning. There was no existential threat. There was nobody that was, we weren't going to lose out on our previous phone, right? Because we didn't have a previous phone. So it's a kind of a different transition. It's like, how do you transition into a whole new business? Not how you transition an existing business into a new platform. How do you create a new platform? And the motivations and the thinking are different. But to Neaton's point about the people who were at Apple during the OS transition, who I think were quite virtuous, and I'm really glad they stuck around, and quite crazy. They're just fucking nuts. And that was the same set of people that were in Cupertino to start the iPhone. It really took, you know, it takes finding a set of people who are willing to go on that jihad, right?
Mm-hmm.
And give it their all and believe in it. And you have to be good at your job to do that, and you also have to be nuts. It's you remember the lecture I gave a couple of years ago in Ottawa, Renee Guy?
Yeah, absolutely.
Hubris and ignorance. They're just marvelous for doing that kind of thing. You have to think, how hard can that be? Or you'll never do it. You'll never take the leap. Because if you knew everything ahead of time, like, you'd never start. Like, it's too hard. And so I that's a different type of transition. Whereas, like, the OS transition, and to a certain extent the processor transition, it's more like a gun is to your head, right? You have to do that one. We didn't have to do the iPhone. Completely different thing. But oddly enough, essentially the same people did it, and it was the same attributes, oddly enough, that made them successful. Neaton, I'm talking too long. Jump in.
No, I don't think you're talking too long at all. I think that's exactly right. And so because of that, that's what worries me about. So there are a couple of things that worry me about the, you know, the machine learning and AI thing. One of them is that, I've spent my entire year or my entire career in software development, right? That's just what I've done. And time and again, I've seen, you know, either hardware execs or hardware, you know, or CEOs of hardware centric companies, and they're not necessarily Apple. But you know, a couple of them have been at Apple as well, who have this deep background in hardware and have looked at software and said, software, it's easy, right? I mean, it's not, you know, it's development, but you get to keep changing shit right up until you kick it out the door. You know, that's, how can that not be easier than hardware development, right? And to sort of dismiss it outright as, well, yeah, of course, if we can do hardware, and hardware is, you know, that's what the big boys do, is, you know, we work on hardware, then of course we can do this, you know, this sissy software stuff. That's, you know, that's what we've let the losers do. And, you know, they're the ones who've, you know, fix things in software for years. And so, of course, I understand software. And, you know, and you know, from that, maybe, you know, some processes around that have worked really well in hardware development, as an example. Processes that have worked really well in hardware development to software development, and they've fallen flat. Or, you know, how many times have we seen a hardware-centric company, you know, sort of make a dabble in software only to release something that's just dog shit, right? And
every TV manufacturer ever.
Let's go with exactly.
Exactly.
Every TV manufacturer. Let's throw the car manufacturers in there too,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, it happens time and time again. And I think, by the way, that is kind of sort of what happened with the phone industry as well, right? I mean, that was largely driven by people who had this deep, like, incredible, you know, class-leading understanding of hardware and building small communications devices and radios and telephony and cellular networking. And they took this and they had just barely enough of an understanding of software development to say, okay, yeah, now put an email type thing on there, and you know, and let's just make it so these notification type things come through very, very quickly and reliably. And we're done. You know, what more do we need? And then they just got smoked by, yes, a hardware company, but they got smoked by the software that was running on this on the hardware, right?
Yep.
And I'm talking specifically about Palm and BlackBerry and yeah, mostly just those two. So here's what worries me is, here I am, I'm a software guy, right? And I've now just told you about how, you know, how when hardware people have tried to mimic or have tried to gain an understanding of software, they've underestimated it. They've dismissed it. They've applied very, they've applied very incorrect or insufficient techniques for developing it, right? And now I'm saying, well, this AI stuff, I don't really see a benefit to it. And how hard can it be if if Apple wants to buy a solution later, right? In other words, what I'm saying is, I feel like I'm the hardware guy looking at AI, and my natural inclination is to kind of dismiss it or to say, well, okay, I have some, you know, some basic understanding of how machine learning works, and how hard can it really be? You know, it's just bits, man. You know, the Apple can go buy that shit later. You know,
yeah, that's the hubris and discounting the difficulty.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely, and that part worries me a little bit. But I can't be too worried about it until I've seen somebody actually have a compelling product for which AI is critical, or have shown a way of making money in some way that, you know, where AI is central to, right, to that success.
Yeah, and the point I was point. Making, yeah. We don't know that Apple isn't doing that, because, right, you know, they publish all the notes to all the engineering meetings they have all the time, right?
Well, I mean, like, there are external, like Apple has, if when you agree to use location on iOS, for example, you're agreeing to let them analyze your traffic data. I mean, they do have this sort of process going on in many facets of the company.
Yeah.
Let's just agree for the sake of argument that what they haven't talked about doesn't exist.
that's the third. Fair,
but I mean, it's an yeah. argument weighted against Apple, but.
Right. Yeah. But fine. Often, you know, like, that
let's
is
continue
a...
with a.
Yeah,
well, but because they could be on Mars. Larger, we don't know. Maybe they're great guys on Mars, but you know,
often it is a larger thing than what does exist. It sure as hell was that way in the early 2000s, right? Neaton, we had more shit inside the walls than we had in people's hands.
I still do.
And that was a problem for a while.
But I think argument, like, if we just distill down to the argument that a lot of people have made, it's that you never see disruption coming. And if you use the BlackBerry example, you know, those two gentlemen were dead set that the future of mobile was hardware keyboards and data compression, that was what people would want. And they just couldn't imagine a world where there was multi-touch and ubiquitous broadband internet. And it's not so much that they ran out of business, but they ran out of relevance, which can be even worse. And I think the argument here is that Apple, and a lot of people love Apple dearly, is so focused on privacy and security and local and other things that machine learning and AI are going to be the next version of multi-touch and ubiquitous broadband. And they're treating it with a lack of seriousness that people saw BlackBerry teach, you know, what this generation of mobile was.
Sure, but how do you monetize that?
Oh, I don't have any answers, guy. I just pose the questions.
Yeah, no, but I think he brought that up, and I think the point is, like, yes, okay, maybe Apple's going to miss out on what? On what are they going to miss out? Is pretty compelling.
And are they going to miss out?
Now, an AI assistant that lives your life with you.
I don't know.
Sure, like, so an AI assistant, like Tony Stark style assistant, there is value in that. I don't know how you make money off it, but I mean, if you are using technology, if you are the company that is using technology to make your customers' lives better, you are winning at the goal of being a tech company, in at least, well, a tech provider. But how you make money matters. Like, you can't be a giant company and just kind of make money giving out Jarvis to everybody. Like, Jarvis needs to try to sell
Amazon
every 10 seconds.
Unless you're Amazon. So we'll make it up in volume.
Buttons to make you buy. Like, Amazon is a store. That is their goal. Any way that can make you buy something, that's their goal. And it happens that a lot of the things we ask about are things we want to buy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I think the interesting thing will happen is is it 2-3 weeks this WWDC? But the more interesting WWDC, frankly, will be the one next year, I think.
In a lot of ways, yeah.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, it's going to take Apple some time to digest what's been going on. And I mean, you know, another example that comes to mind is Apple Pay.
Yeah.
Right? When you know, and I don't think I'm – well, I probably am. maybe I'm giving away something by saying this, but Apple Pay was, or what would eventually become Apple Pay was under serious investigation at Apple before I left, and that was one, and it was one of these things where, you know, there was an understanding that okay, there's this, you know, this whatever the fuck it was called, the Google Pay, or it wasn't Android Pay, I don't think, because that's
Google Wallet.
Yeah,
Google Wallet,
right? You know, so now all of a sudden there are going to be these Android phones out there, and they're all going to work very nicely with these point of sale systems, and people are going to see that, and they're going to want to be able to do that themselves. And oh, you can't do that with an iPhone. So, you know, that's Apple is now at a huge disadvantage, because the more point of sale systems there are out there, and the more Android phones out there. The more opportunity there's going to be for people to actually see this and say, well, I want that, and Apple doesn't have it, and they're now going to move to Android. Yeah. And Apple did a very good job of sort of sticking to their guns and realizing that, okay, yes, they could have thrown an NFC part in a phone much earlier than they did, but it wasn't until they had a clear understanding of how Apple Pay can work worldwide for starters, and then also how, you know, what's in it for Apple as far as the, you know, getting in on some of the you know, the network transaction fees and things like that, right? I mean, Apple's going to go through an awful lot of trouble to put these things in and you know, these NFC parts in, and it's going to eat a little bit into battery life, it's going to attenuate the antennas a tiny bit, it's going to do all of these different things. So where is the benefit for Apple? And it wasn't until they actually struck deals with some of these, it was either the banks or the networks, I don't remember at the moment, but it wasn't until these deals were in place and they had an understanding of how that was all going to scale worldwide that Apple Pay finally was this thing that became realized, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think the same thing is going on here where, you know, it's just so tempting to say Apple's going to miss the boat, you know, and how many times have people said Apple's going to miss the boat on all of these things, you know, only to find out a couple of years later that, you know, holy shit, Apple has been working on this thing the whole time, and they have a better solution than anybody, and they've actually figured out how to make money on this thing for themselves.
Exactly.
Right? Because I can tell you, that whole
you
industry...
actually, with the Apple Pay analogy, made my point better than I did, and with fewer words. Thank you.
Fewer words. Well, it didn't feel that way. But
by the way, a little answer in that the Apple Pay thing. One stick in the mud on doing the NFC thing right away. Who doesn't get enough credit for that? Who was saying no? Let's not go there right away. Was Scott Forstall? He was all for let's figure this out. Let's make sure we understand before, you know, we create the Wild West for our devices and nobody understands how to use them. And I think, I mean, you were in some of those exec review meetings where Scott was like, you know, not yet, this doesn't make sense yet.
Right. Well, so, and I was even in some of the meetings where Peter Oppenheimer was saying the same thing. He was saying, well, what, you know, why do we need this magical chip to do this, you know, and what really what's in it for us?
Yeah. I mean, and you also got on the other side for both these people, they weren't like inhibiting work because you could also tell they're having the conversations. They want to do it, but they weren't throwing shade on going that direction. They were like, let's try to be thoughtful. Let's figure out a plan. What's the end point? Right.
As a customer, I like how Apple very seldom just rolls out chipsets, but they roll out feature sets. Because some companies, they just can't wait to get the latest chipset into a device and they'll figure out what to do with it later, where Apple will figure out a feature set and then sort of know what technology they need to bring it to market.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah, definitely. I mean, and I think that's one of the problems with the Android world, right, is that the people who are making hardware, they don't want to think about the feature set, right? They don't want to think about, you know, because it's hard, it's complicated, you know, and it could lead to additional work that you have to do. Just give me the requirements and tell me what part you want in there, and I will deliver that. You know, I'm speaking as the hardware company, right? And I will deliver this, you know, this box to you, and now it's on you to put whatever the hell you need to in Android, and you know, let's together turn this into a successful product, right? And you know, and I think a lot of that is just because it is very hard to do, and it's, you know, it's tough to bridge that gap. And you know, to Apple's credit, they're still good at it.
They're very good. Their hardware and software teams are very good at figuring out the endpoints together and iterating on those things. It is not always a polite marriage. There is a lot of yelling around the kitchen table and sometimes in the bedroom. But it works, and it's always worked there. It's just, it's in their DNA. That's what they're good at, because they're not just a hardware company and they're not just a software company. And everybody in hardware realizes that, and everybody in software realizes that. The thing that Apple has slowly come to terms with and is finally getting some expertise, although it's sure as hell taken a long time, is this whole idea of services. And things like Apple Pay, and way before that, the iTunes Store, which is in a sense, when you think about it, it's a service. Apple started dipping their feet into that kind of thing and understanding that. What's the only service Apple ever did before the iTunes Store? It was that damn AOL clone that nobody remembers, right?
E-World.
E-World.
And so, remembers.
I still get emails from Newton's
and E-World when people, including myself, who says Apple doesn't know their shit about services, you know, they change the world when it comes to music with what's essentially a service, right? It wasn't the iPod that changed the world. It was the iPod married to the iTunes Store. So do they always do it in the way that we want them to? Have they always done the best implementations? You know, hell no. But they're gonna get there.
Well, so okay, so that's kind of gets to the root of my question. Apple's really good.
Damn, that was only an hour and six minutes, and
Apple's
we covered it.
Really well. Now I'm going to actually ask you the question. So another five hours, and I'm going to leave for dinner in about an hour and a half. But you can just keep talking.
They won't notice. They won't notice.
Like an hour and a half after that, it's fine. Apple, you say, works well towards getting to endpoints, both the hardware and the software and the team and the company as a whole. I think how the company determines that endpoint and how it, you know, how you steer the ship to get to it is kind of the crux of what I'm trying to get to.
That's a hard one.
Yeah. Well, that's why
it's a real hard
slide. Some smart people on, but
Who?
You know, they're coming up. We're going to have an ad break.
And now for the smart people.
Some smart people come on and tell us how that can happen. But I'm serious. It's like picking the endpoint is like, that's, you know, it's kind of where the game's at, right? So.
Well, part of it is you can pick the endpoint in a meta in a large way. And Steve was really good at that. You know, he picked the endpoint. It's touch. We're going to make a touch device. And he fudged then like part of the way into the endpoint. And it's going to be a phone. It's not going to be a tablet.
Yeah.
Not right now.
Yeah, it's fine. That's the purpose of the position. Right. Like.
And so, so you have to have that at the high level. You have to understand that.
Right.
But the truth is in figuring out the endpoint, you do not write the full specification up front. Nobody does that. It's an iterative process. But la tema, you have to have the theme. You have to have what you're going for, right?
Here's a concrete question.
It's a larger target, and then you figure out the other stuff. But in doing the iPhone, and I was involved very, very early on in that, and then it became sort of like peripheral to that at the time when Neaton stepped in and and became even more involved because he was actually writing code, poor bastard, is that we didn't know exactly what it was going to be to start out with, because we didn't know what it was possible to build. And so you say, here's this thing in the distance and we want to get there. Let's head that direction. How many steps are there across the line, you know, to the in the line there? How many increments, right? Can we figure out what that is, right?
Well, okay, so here's one concrete example. Neon Classic, before it was called Classic, OS X comes down the pipe. Just as a concrete example of changing direction. What did that speech from the manager look like?
Yeah, so it's interesting. I mean, there was, so the speech from management at the time, I mean, and
I know I'm being dramatic and it's like a Game of Thrones-y kind of thing, but I mean, at some point it's like, we're going to go do this.
It really was a Game of Thrones-y kind
of
thing.
Well, yeah, I don't want to oversell it as like something super dramatic, but
yeah. Oh yeah, well, and I was going to chip away at the, you know, the dramatic effect anyway, that, you know, that there wasn't a single speech or anything like that. But really, you know, it was, oh God, let me see the time. I mean, it was understood that, that the upper management around, software development was coming from, it was going to be one of Steve's guys, right? It was going to be part of the management team from that came from Next, specifically Avi Tavanian, right? And it was also understood that one of the big things that we actually bought Next, one of the reasons we bought Next and we didn't buy this other company called B at the time, was because of their technology. And so, you know, because we are now buying their technology and we have this guy who's coming in, who's done nothing but develop this technology up until that point, and he was now coming to Apple to run the operating system group, that, you know, it was pretty easy to sort of put the to do the math and figure out what direction we were going to go.
He wrote the kernel.
Right, exactly.
He's not like some guy that came he wrote the kernel.
He didn't come fresh from manager class at college to do it.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
He's definitely Brainiac level kind of guy.
Anyway. It was kind of, to talk to some of the veterans at the time, it was kind of refreshing that none of them came from management class at university.
Absolutely.
Well, Avi, Bertrand, Scott, anybody, they were making it up as they went.
And that was definitely a something refreshing. You know, at the time I was more part of the, you know, kind of the engineering rank and file. And that was something that we had talked about all the time was, God, I wish we could get some execs in place who actually had a background, like a real actual background in shipping software or in developing software, because those are the kinds of people who, you have a, when you're talking to somebody who has a software, or I imagine hardware, but what I know is software. If you're talking to somebody who has a software development background, you can immediately sort of go into a vocabulary and go into kind of a shared understanding of how the world works and how development works. And you don't have to explain the most simple concepts, right? It's just, you get it, right? The management just gets it. And when you come to them and say, what you're asking for is fantastic, but you're going, you know, here are the areas where there are going to be race conditions, or here are the areas that we have, you don't have to explain what a race condition is, right? You don't have to.
Much more effective meetings and conversations. Yeah.
Yes.
Plus, it makes it feel good.
You're
when
speaking
you
the same
file.
Language. You're speaking the same language. And that was, and all the veterans told me that was the thing that gave them heart. It wasn't like the troop of one knuckleheaded manager, middle or senior manager after another, that had been marching through Apple for the last 5 to 10 years, right?
Right.
Even
exactly.
Just something simple, like on the outside, if I opened up like a mock header file, like mock_types, Avi's name is right there.
Mm-hmm.
And he's running the show, and you're like, okay, well, this guy clearly knows what he's talking about. So,
well, yeah,
that makes me feel good. I mean, like,
yeah, unless you disagreed about message passing and microkernels.
Oh, sure.
Boy, did those arguments get heated. But
I digress. He was not a manager guy. He's like, this is a Harvard Tech guy, you know, like he.
Yeah, and it also changed the dynamic. I think in a very good way. And it was one of the reasons that, you know, I just constantly had imposter syndrome when I was there, because, you know, as I've said before, my management chain was, you know, when Scott Forstall, Bertrand Serlet, Avi Tavene, and Steve Jobs. And like every day you go to work, you think you're like a fucking idiot because these people they're brilliant, and you can't pull any bad technical shit on them. I mean, you know, Avi wrote the kernel. Bertrand wrote Malloc. I mean, for God's sakes. I mean, Scott was the one who came up with the whole idea of, you know, and selling it to other people, doing Carbon. Probably one of the most brilliant hacks at Apple at the time. And so...
if it makes you feel better, Don, you're still a bit of an idiot.
Oh, thank you. Well, that's a relief. So you just always went into work, you know, making sure you or into any meeting what you were doing. And I think there was some and I think Neaton was alluding to this earlier. There was a little slough off of some people when the new folks came in at Apple for that transition. And I think part of that was a set of people who didn't, probably the vast majority of people didn't like change. And there were other people who were like, I don't want to put up with this. I don't want to put up with all this scrutiny kind of thing. And there was probably a few of them who just went, you know, I'll just take my shares that are worth very little and leave. Did you find that to be true, Neaton?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'm good friends with a small handful of those people. and so, yeah, absolutely. I mean, and there was a, it was also, you know, I think people, as much as they wanted somebody who had an engineering background, I think that for some of those people, they were used to having someone who was kind of a pushover in that position, or they were used to having somebody who they could say, oh no, I'm, you know, let me give you these hand wavy reasons why that thing that you want is really hard. And we're not going to be able to put, you know, the Linux kernel on a Mac and have it work like a Mac. You know, that was a bad example that I used, but it was, people were used to having management in place that they could snow. Yeah. And, you know, and they liked that. And so when somebody comes in and they're very opinionated and they're, you know, and they're running things how they're creating a vision exactly how they see it. People either buy into it or they don't. And for a lot of people, you know, Don, like you were saying, some people just believed that message passing with the kernel was just a fundamentally flawed architecture to begin with, and that everything else just, you know, everything beyond that is just completely unworkable. And so, if this guy is so, you know, talking about Avi, if this guy is so stuck on message passing and, you know, and I think that it's so wrong, you know, I have no respect for him, and I can't work for somebody like that, you know. And some of those people scampered off to hardware, some, you know, most of those people left the company. Yeah. But yeah, you know, I mean, and I think that comes with those cultural shifts as well, as, you know, and to his credit, I think, you know, Steve was one who really just sort of put it out there and just brought it out, you know, just put it out there, you know, right out in the open in at least one communications meeting that I was in, where he said, I mean, he very explicitly said, this is our new direction. This is the way we're going. You either need to be completely on board with this or get out. Get out. You're not doing yourself a favor by half-assing it here. You're sucking the wind out of other people's sails who do believe in it by sticking around. You're not doing anybody any favors. So I would really appreciate it if you people would just leave. Now, you know, as you can imagine, you know, I mean, that's, it might have been a little off-putting for some folks to actually hear that.
I think that's misconstrued, though. It's pro-team. maybe you feel bad, yes. but it's well, really pro but not team. Everybody like, has... Are you invested or not?
Right. Yeah.
But yeah. not everybody has the guts to do that. And in fact, that was something that was lacking at our transition at Netscape. You know, Andreessen didn't give give the get on board or get the fuck out speech, and he should have, because it would have streamlined things tremendously. I mean, in some senses, it would have made some stuff harder, but he wasn't that type of manager. Steve had the kind of some would say ego, but it was really the kind of the guy who can see the thing that's not there and, you know, see the prize off in the distance and know that that's the right thing to do. As an aside, I would add that the whole Apple as a functional organization really began then. Mm-hmm. Because Apple, before Steve came back, was balkanizing itself like a traditional kind of company. And the functional organization really started there. And some people would say it was a piece of brilliance on Steve's part. I'm of the opinion, though. I mean, people like to, even at Apple, like to, you know, rewrite history that this way. But fundamentally, this is the only way these guys knew how to run a company. They just ran it like a really large version of Next. That's really what Apple is. It's still a very large version of Next. I can't tell. Someone's laughing back there. Is that you, Neaton?
That's me. No, I think you're. I think I never worked at Next, but I think you're right that, you know, as much as we're giving, you know, Steve and maybe other people credit for you know, pondering the best way to create an organization, I have a feeling that it really just came down to more practical issues and more of a.
Yeah.
You know, I want to hear directly from the hardware VP how things are going, you know, and we're not going to create a profit and loss center for every single one of these divisions and start playing funny little games with finances. And
Bertrand and others, they didn't want to fuck with that stuff. They didn't have time for it when they were like, because they were reviewing code along with the engineers.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe there's been like a lot of business analysis, which is literary criticism, where you're reading in an awful lot.
That's a really good analogy.
It's just actually, like, shit up. I don't know.
Oh yeah.
Oh, let me ask you this: has there been a direction decided that you guys were not on board on, and how did you get convinced that it was a good idea? And then how did you convince the people you needed to, you know, that reported to you?
Oh, boy,
if the answer is simply it never happened, that's interesting. But...
Oh, no. I think it happened the pass down for me. But yeah. I've always been a rather agreeable sort. So, you know, whatever wacky thing, you know, Scott would tell me is like, and I'm thinking like, I'm going to win an argument with Scott. I was like, well, I guess I get on board now. And I get the head count. It was more about convincing my people that, you know, sometimes, I tell a joke about the name Safari, you know, my team hated that the first time they heard that, you know, I had to convince them that was a good idea. And that was a very, very minor thing.
And the way that's a put your foot down thing. That's like,
but
it's out of my control and shut up.
Right. But there were other people who, balked at, they balk less at doing the project because, you know, they're not stupid. Like they have the forethought of saying, well, the phone, you know, doing a phone is a good idea. We got to get in the business. They're more balking about how that is going to be approached or done, you know, because everybody wants to quarterback that, right? And so you have to convince people that, you know, no, this is this person over here. Or this team has the ball, right? We're blocking, right? And I don't have times.
Yeah, you don't get to armchair quarterback their team,
right? Yeah. It's like our job is to take, you know, is to take people down so the quarterback can throw the ball and the other person, you know, can get the catch in the end zone and be on ESPN. You know, we're not, you know, it's hard to convince people they're going to do the ugly stuff and wind up in the mud sometimes.
Yeah. I think we just had the best sports analogy ever on the show.
Yep. Definitely.
So the other person will get the sack of stuff and put it in the end zone.
Yeah. So, I think it's more like, Neaton, yeah, you've run into the situation yourself or.
God, I'm racking my brain here. It has to have happened, and I just can't freaking remember when it has, because I'm certainly not agreeable to just, you know, okie dokie every single thing that, you know, every single crazy thing that Steve or Scott came up with. But
well,
I just
every single thing. I mean, they made decisions for me that I just ignored sometimes. You know, so Steve killed one of my projects one time, and. Scott said, just, you know, went, took me to the side and said, just keep doing it. I'll work on it. And so, so I just kept doing it.
So Alexander for Longhorn lived.
Yeah, exactly. Longhorn it was.
Yeah. I can't think of any, I mean, I know this makes me sound like a huge, you know, company man, but I can't think of anything after sort of the Steve and Scott, you know, change in leadership for me anyway, mm-hmm. that was super objectionable. I mean, maybe there were some things around like, you know, kind of the original garbage collection work where it was like, oh my God, this is such a giant asset for us. Like, why do we expect anybody to be able to do that? Like, this is, you know, if you're looking for us to be guinea pigs on this, and tell you, well, you know, if this is viable and if this is working well or not, I'm telling you, this isn't fucking working.
Yeah.
You know, and you know,
I hadn't realized that had hit.
That's a great example, because if you talk to Bertrand about that, and I called him on that one, because yeah. I could tell too. In a meeting, I said, Bertrand, you don't even believe this. And he was like, yeah, you're right. Probably a stupid thing to do. And he told me like a year later, it was a stupid thing to do. But when Lattner came on board and came up with ARG, or
AOC. Reference County.
But it had a much better name at the beginning.
Oh, yeah. It was like a pirate thing. Yeah, automatic retain release. ARG. Yeah.
Automatic retain and release. And Bertrand was like, you know, how quickly can we jettison garbage collection? And get everything over to AOC. Yeah. So.
Yeah, but even in that case, I mean, so even though I was, you know, I was objecting to, you know, the original garbage collection and you know was squawking about that up the management chain, we were still being good Boy Scouts and still, you know, doing So, you know, even that's maybe not a great example. I don't know. I mean, maybe this is. You know, maybe you have the two most agreeable managers in Apple on this podcast.
Well,
I don't think so. Real pranks. those other people you're bringing in.
No, I just think that it speaks well to the way Apple picks its managers and stuff, and that they don't tend to make dumb decisions. And even when they do with it, I don't think GC was a dumb decision, but it was a road that led to nowhere.
Yeah, right. Well, we didn't have anything else at the time, as Ron explained to us. You know, if somebody can explain to me like how we can do this, you know, how we can achieve the same thing, let's do that. But you know, let's try this now, right?
The goal is worthy. Here's an attempt to solve it.
Yeah.
Okay. That not the greatest. You know, let's try again.
But totally again. Fine. Yeah. Again, going to transitions in Apple, you know, people are trembling about the whole idea of like Apple doing a whole new OS or doing a new hardware platform or this or whatever. Jesus, the last company you should ever worry about handling a transition is Apple. Oh, God, so many. I guess by the time Marklar rolled around, nobody feared it. You know, it's
the funny thing with Marklar is that they'd been shipping OS X developer previews that ran on Intel up until DP3. So DP2, I believe, still ran on Intel. And then, I mean, I don't know what people expected. What you think that they would just not keep up working on Intel?
Yeah, but it wasn't.
Like, even if it's way behind, even if it's way behind, I mean, you just whatever. You have a couple of people on it, just keeping it up to date.
Well, yeah. Well, it's like when Steve did the rollout at WWDC, and he said, you know, we've Next Step is always run on Intel. We've always kept it running in the background to make sure it compiled.
Yeah, like you say, you saw it in 2001. That's the year OS X shipped.
Yeah.
So pretty clear.
Pretty sure it was the end of 2001.
Pretty clear there wasn't like a window where it was just not working. So.
Oh, no. No, it was not.
To some degree.
It was not working for the whole OS or to actually run an app. You could get DARWA. See, there are different things there. Yes, you know,
so, yeah, DARWA would always... I'm glossing over it a bit. Yeah, DARWA and the Finder, the window manager and all of that could take extra work. Darwin was always an Intel thing for sure, even publicly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All the ifdefs and everything else were still in the code, and we maintained those.
Yeah.
So anyway, to back up. Yeah, I guess Neaton and I are just kind of agreeable. This was not something that the big leaps like this were not something we were worried about. I mean, the stuff we would argue about or drag our feet about was like the mouse shits stuff, right? It, you know, it was some of the details. It wasn't the big task. When the pole went in the ground and everybody said, we're going that way, it was like, oh, I guess we're going that way. That was never a problem. And when we would do software releases and, you know, you'd draw a line in the sand and Bertrand would say we'd release on this date and we go like, you're nuts. And it was just pretty much a given. That's, you know, that's like flowers in the springtime. You know, we would always argue with him about things like that. Henri, you know, would always argue with Scott about the same thing with iOS. But that's just, you know, that's not the same kind of thing. It's not like I'm not on board in doing this whole thing. You know, I'm just, we're having a disagreement about the details or the process.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like we didn't have a system for working that out. Frankly, it was a hell of a lot less drama than at other companies I've been at that way. Simply because we just didn't have the time for the drama or the particular appetite.
Right. Or the energy or yeah. Anything.
Yeah.
I wonder if what you're hearing, Guy, is a consequence of the culture at Apple.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wonder if what, you know, the thing, you know, that Don and I talking about how we were very agreeable. Maybe it's not that we were very agreeable, but maybe it was more.
he's trying to say we're not stupid.
No, it's clearly because you're both from inside the company and therefore would be as blind to oncoming disruption as people in the company itself.
No.
Well, I'm not going to rule that out entirely. I mean, that's certainly a possibility. But maybe that's a consequence of what I was going to say was that maybe the people who were, you know, who sort of stuck around and were, you know, left behind and, you know, and decided to stick this thing out and make a go of it were the kind who already bought off on sort of upper management's positions on a lot of these things and on, you know, and you know, sort of the meta, you know, the big thing that Steve was pushing was let's make the best possible products that we can and everything else will follow from that. You know, and so, you know, as long as we believe that the steps that we're taking are going to lead to the best possible products, then everything else will just kind of take care of itself. Or that's stuff that we don't, you know, on the development side, we don't have to worry about that. All we have to worry about is making the absolute best possible product. And part of making the best possible product is making the best possible team to produce those products year after year. Yeah. But you know, I mean, that's just part of the job of a manager, right? Is doing that. But you know, I just don't think that we heard that many crazy requests at that time.
Oh.
Well, you know, maybe they just didn't sound crazy to us.
Yeah. Well, it goes back to the things where the herd was thinned back in the 90s and everybody that was had that kind of recalcitrant streak, they essentially left the company. And that goes to the virtue that I was talking about, who remained. Those who remained were a team. They were willing, to go and fight for the cause, to take up the banner of the jihad. And, you know, this is kind of crazy, but, you know, hey, sue us for making all that money. it just got bred into everybody. Either good or bad, you tend to hire people that are like you, right?
Oh, yeah, I mean, that was one of
the... Sure, this is a real problem with diversity, but in terms of this part of the culture, it actually turned out to be a good thing.
That was definitely one of the questions that we would ask in our engineering interviews was, tell me about a feature or a product that you worked on that you absolutely hated, but that you actually delivered as well.
I got that question in my interview.
Did you? Okay.
Yeah.
All right. See,
I forget who asked it, but I got that question.
That's a good one.
Yeah. I mean, and it really speaks to, you know, can people divorce their own personal opinions from the work that they do, you know, and can they do the best possible work no matter what they're being asked to do? And they may not, you know, and I think that's the, you know, that's the thing is, okay, I'll bring up one, but I came around on it relatively quickly, was the iPad. When it actually came time to first come out with a tablet form factor, you know, and maybe it was just because I had been jaded and I had been seeing, you know, these tablet things since the days of EO. There was this company, you know, in the very early 90s that had, Windows or you know, something like
they had that like pen computing
thrust. Right, all the pen computing stuff, right? Yeah. I had seen that come and go and had been hearing about how tablets are the future, you know, for I had been hearing about tablets being the future for fucking 15 years by that point. And now you're going to come and tell me that we're working on a tablet, you know, that was something that I had to personally come around on, pretty quickly, but, you know, I think it didn't take much.
To your credit, I don't think it took you more than a few days.
It really did.
Seriously. Seriously. If that much.
Yeah.
And to Dean's credit also, I'd say part of the reason you have that reaction at that point is, Neaton was more than ass deep in deadlines and iPhone land at the same time. And it's like a lot of folks had that same initial reaction, like, you want us to do what else?
Yeah,
and I think that was part, like, part of it.
What, 3-2, right? That it was
right.
Yeah.
Spy, it was, that was, yeah. So the day it was announced, I went to a friend's house. Neaton, you can't fire them anymore. So I went to a friend's house, and yeah, I saw an iPad, and I was like, I was not convinced by the demo. I thought, okay, that's interesting. But when they showed it to me, I didn't get to touch it, so it was all within the rules. I was sold. That was awesome. And I can see. For myself, I would also be like, why are we wasting time on a tablet? I don't get that.
Right.
Now, well, it feels like a little bit like people are pretending that the market is coming to that conclusion too, but I think that's just dumb. Like, they're selling like hotcakes still.
Eventually, you're going to have a touch device for every possible size.
Yeah.
They're just slowly going there.
Yeah. Because they are awesome.
The thing that I asked early on, and that I believe Neaton asked the same question in a meeting, and you might have actually phrased it this way, Neaton, is, how do we make this not be just a big-ass phone, right? That was Greg's worry too, right? How do we do that?
Yeah, I think that was – yeah, and – well, I think I may have been a little bit more extreme, which was, we can't just make this a big-ass phone.
Yeah.
Right? I think it was more of a – it was – because it was like, well, imagine a table view, right? Nobody had an iPad at the time, right? Everybody had iPhones. But go look in contacts and go scroll on that thing. Now tell me that that's what you want to see on a tablet.
Right.
It's horrible.
I had an early Android tablet. I did see that on a tablet.
Exactly. Yeah. They made the mistake of actually shipping that, you know. But yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Like minimum, you need a split view, like bare minimum.
Right, right. Bare minimum. Yeah.
And absolutely. So we were all worried about the amount of work, which is why a lot of my team was immediately called into indentured servitude for Henri's team, which I didn't mind at all.
Have I thanked you for that?
I actually, there was like 6 months there where you actually got to sleep at night and every once in a while with your family. Because of me. So, yes, you're welcome.
thank you.
And then we handed it over afterwards because that was also the right thing to do. Looking at that, we saw that this was going to be a big problem. We didn't want to ship, as Neaton said, a big ass phone, but we also didn't want to kill ourselves either. That was the other worry, and why right. There was some like heel dragging. It's like, holy shit, this is another, you know, this is another march to Bataan, right? And so, you know, there were a few people who were gun shy, and there were some people we lost in iOS land during the iPad effort that, you know, they blew a gusset. Mm-hmm. Some of them came back later on, but some of them just had to go to another area of the company for like 6 months and just fold paper for a while.
Vacation.
So, man, those poor people.
But yeah. that happens. That happens yeah. at Apple. Yeah. That happens in a lot of different groups. You know, you just, because they are, they're not fungible coding units. They're right. units, and so you have to. We were sure using them like fungible coding units. So what do we need?
Absolutely.
So it's hard, and so you have a little chafing when the direction of the ship swerves suddenly to the side from that mm-hmm. kind of thing also, but it's not the kind of problem where you have like, this is the absolutely wrong thing to do. You're going to wreck the company. As Neaton says, I don't ever remember anything in a conversation about that. I mean, when I first got to Apple with my crazy ass project that I was like super enthusiastic about, nobody ever came up to me and said, we shouldn't do a web browser. People came up to me all the time and told me how to do a web browser, which got really fucking annoying. But nobody said we shouldn't do that. That's a completely different thing. So
I've spent my career browsing the internet. So let me tell you how to make a web browser, Don.
Exactly.
I just keep trying to launch Safari on my watch, and it doesn't take.
You know, and my team, they never appreciated this until years later, because they were mad at me for like keeping them in a bubble. They were like, "Well, we don't get to interact with other people." You know, this was during the first year to 18 months, and you know, you're not letting us out to interact with people, and I'm like. I'm thinking to myself, I'm not letting you do it because I want you to stay at your jobs because I'm afraid of workplace violence. Like, fucking kill some of these people. I mean, people wonder why shit doesn't bother me. I have so thick of a skin after, you know, and plus when it actually comes out for real and you do a web browser, then everybody wants to tell you even after the fact, after it's done, what's wrong with it, right? So, you know, nothing bothers me, like stab me with pins like that. And so
did I mention
part,
you
part, that, part, of course, what?
A couple of months ago, my son was actually sitting, my 13-year-old son was sitting down and was trying to tell me how to use an iPhone. And I didn't say anything. I just went along. But my wife, too, you know, bless her soul, she was like, you know what your dad did, right? she was the one who actually had to stop him and stop him from looking even more foolish. Because yeah, absolutely. You know, it's just, that's just how it goes, right? And I'm sure people will tell you, you know, all the things you screwed up with Safari and.
yep.
Yeah.
After a while, I just smile. It's not a problem. Mm-hmm. Problem.
Kind of want to put that on a t-shirt.
Yeah.
After a while, I just smile.
It even rhymes.
The Don Melton story. Yeah.
Now, is that going to, what side is going to say, everybody just calm the fuck down?
The back side of the shirt.
Well, it's because of the ladder that you get the former.
No. The front side of the shirt is, when they see me coming, it's everybody calm the fuck down. The back side is the other thing.
So anyway, it
was not the big things. It was never the big strategy thing where it was going to balk. I can't speak for what happened in boardrooms, in Steve's own meetings or things, because I was never there.
Yeah.
So I'm sure they had a few arguments there. But I heard of very few executives leave the company because at that time, back in the beginning, you know, because of the huge direction, you know, that they disagree with the company. I mean, there were some people who left.
Well, back in what, 2000?
No. I'm like talking about mid-2000s people leaving I'm talking about after Steve came in and got rid of the knuckleheads and that were, you know, in upper management. After that, there weren't a lot of people from upper management coming in and leaving because they had huge disagreements. Except the only one I can think of really at the moment is Mr. Nest.
Tony Fadell.
Yeah, Tony Fadell. And I can't think of his name all of a sudden, and I feel embarrassed because I...
Rubenstein?
No, well, yeah, but it wasn't really...
Those guys seem like special cases because they're in the iPod side of stuff, right? So not special cases, but you know what I mean? Like it's a...
They're in a unique position.
Yeah.
Well, iPod, I feel, was different than most of Apple.
Yeah. So, but certainly down at the other ranks, when you would have people leave was very few times I knew people that were leaving Apple for some huge, better opportunity in the 2000s. Because in the beginning, there was just so much upside and excitement about the things we were doing, even though nobody in the outside world gave a shit about it. And by the time everything became successful, nobody wanted to leave because, holy crap, look at how successful this all is. The people who were leaving were people who were leaving because they were just burned out from all that wonderful success, right?
So this is okay. You know, the late 90s, 2000s, to use a term that came up earlier, thinned the herd a little bit, and the people were true believers that were there. And when Steve rallied them, it worked, even though they were presented with their own failings. They believed in the company and they wanted to see us succeed.
I was not there at the time.
I'm trying to sum up what you both said. Like, is that still the Apple we've got now?
There's
a lot of people.
No.
No.
I don't think it is. I don't think it could possibly be the same Apple that it was then, just because there's been this recent history of just wild success.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that attracts, you know, not only does it attract the faithful, which I think it always will, right? There's just always going to be this constant inflow of people who were as enamored, you know, with Apple as I was when I was, you know, a teenager and aspire to work there and they should be.
It's an aspiring company.
Right. But in addition, you know, that now there are also the people who read about, you know, Apple's, you know, historic, you know, profits or the, you know, that their huge influence over the industry or, you know, that there's a lot of now, you know, Apple isn't the company that used to be great anymore, right? Apple is great. Apple is fantastic now. And so if you're coming out of school, I mean, there are some people, and I can say this because I have relatives who are like this too, you know, there are people who look at a company and they want to go work there just because everybody knows that company or just because everybody has heard that name and they associate it with success, and they think that if they go and work at that company and that company has been successful, now they are by extension successful, right?
Yeah, it's the General Motors or the DuPont or what, like you
right.
get into good company, get a good life, get a good paycheck, work.
Right. You know, your but mom no is very pension. Happy. You know, you can go, yeah. No.
Well, okay, that's a separate thing. But I mean, like the concept of joining a solid company is a sound one and time-honored tradition.
Right. Yeah. But it's not going to attract the not necessarily. I don't think it's going to necessarily attract the people who are going to, you know, burn the candle at both ends, or the people who are, you know, just the people who treat it more like a cause. And I think that there's something that's lost with that. And actually, this is something I wanted to mention, I don't know, 4 hours ago, whenever we started this, but I think that, you know, it'd be very interesting to talk to people who were around for the Microsoft transition to the internet, right? That the people who were at Microsoft, who were part of Windows 95, right? Windows 95 was obviously just this enormous success. And then all of a sudden, now everybody was being shifted to this thing called the internet. And you know, now we need to, you know, turn the company, you know, 90 degrees and go and look at this thing and take this thing head on. And
yeah. And what sounds like a very dramatic, I mean, Bill Gates was like, okay, nah, we miss the internet. We're getting on board.
Exactly. But the thing that's in that Apple has in common with Microsoft back then is Microsoft was wildly successful at the time. Mm-hmm. Right. And I think that, you know, to Microsoft's credit, it's so much harder, you know, to pull off these big shifts and to make these, you know, these big changes when you are wildly successful. And we've seen, you know, that there's just this graveyard of companies who they've been wildly successful right up until, you know, the bottom falls out and off they go. And Microsoft back in the late 90s, you know, mid to late 90s, they were one of the companies who was actually able to pull this off. And if and when Apple has to pull off this kind of transition in the future, they're going to be an awful lot more like Microsoft in the late 90s than Apple in the late 90s, right? They're going to have that success. They're going to have that.
Right. But the thing to keep in mind is also the difference with Microsoft and the difference with Apple now. And if you want to go back to the BlackBerry analogy, BlackBerry was really a one-trick pony. They had like basically one product. It was the BlackBerry. Apple and Microsoft back then does not have just one product. People focus on it just being Windows, but it really isn't. I mean, that's why Microsoft's still alive now and they're making other transitions. Their services industry right now, that's like brilliance. They've done just a huge pivot on that. And, you know, they're giving AWS a run for its money, right? Mm-hmm. So I don't think Apple is in a single business. They're, if it's not that the bottom will ever fall out of Apple, maybe a bottom, you know, one of the little the little doors there on this huge thing will fall out. But I don't think the whole thing will fall out. And so I think that's the difference. People are making analogies with the wrong thing. And that's, you know, that's probably why Microsoft's going to be around for decades. Sorry.
IBM did something similar too, right? They got out of the PC business and they became a consulting kind of company.
Well, that first time, like, I mean,
they had layoffs.
Big iron business first, right?
Yeah. I mean, but they pivoted. But for like the first time in decades, they had, or maybe the first time ever, they actually laid people off. Late 90s, I believe. Mm-hmm. That sucked. But anyway, I don't think Apple's
there. By the way, speaking of layoffs, people don't remember this, but back in the early 2000s when we weren't making money at Apple.
Pretty sure Nate remembers this.
We had to do layoffs periodically. Had other... I remember doing that, lifeboating my people and laying people off. This happened in... this happened in as late as 2004, I think. 2004 was probably the last time we did it, right?
Yeah, that's my recollection too. But yeah, I mean, yeah, when I joined Apple 6 months later, they were, they'd started with layoffs. And so it was a, oh God, you know, I've only been at this company for 6 months. Of course they're going to lay me off.
Yeah.
Right? You know, it was
like the cafeteria napkins were just pink slips at that point.
Yeah.
Well, that was in, what year was that for you, Neaton? That was in,
that was 93.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Those were the dark,
yes.
Those were the dark days.
I better pour myself another drink.
Yeah.
Damn right.
I mean, if you actually look at it, the Intel transition, so there was the iPod, but then the Intel transition really helped Apple.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Like going to Intel, actually, you started to sell Macs again, which...
Well, and the other thing is...
It turns out to be handy if you're trying to make some money.
And if you were a fanboy or fangirl, you didn't have to make fucking stupid-ass excuses anymore about Apple hardware. It was like, oh, thank God. I don't have to be an apologist for the
IBM
/ Motorola train wreck.
I still like the G5 as a chip. But yeah, that was getting hard to argue about.
But isn't it funny now? Like, you know, even after the Intel, so Apple made this transition, this famous transition to RISC back in the early 90s,
yeah,
right? Believing that the RISC architecture was the future. Then in the early, you know, mid 2000s, I should say, switched over to Intel, and now what's the dominant the far and away dominant CPU architecture?
Thank you.
ARM, Acorn RISC machine.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
It's like right there in the name.
Yeah. So
they had the right bet. They were just ahead of their time.
Exactly.
I think that's true of Next and Apple in various periods of their history.
At this point, with the A8 or A9. It's not really a RISC machine anymore. Seriously.
No, but people lost religion about it, learned to relax, and now we run microkernels that are not really micro, and RISC chips that are not really risky, but things are fine. You know.
Right, but going to the transition, you know, when we were very early on, when I was involved in like taking a look at some of the architecture for what would become the iPhone, before I shipped it over to worry about another panic, and we were looking at chipsets and stuff. And I remember being in a room, not saying anything. I was basically a fly on the wall. And we were talking about chipsets to use and everything. I was very heartened by the fact that, like, you know, everybody was, even back then, focused on battery, smallness, what can we do? And nobody ever worried about what's it going to take to move, you know, the OS, the core of Mac OS X or Darwin over to another chipset. By that time, that's what I was saying, Marklar was the last time it was, you know, any kind of a big deal to do a big, and it wasn't even that big a deal to do a big transition. Everybody just figured, before the project started, they just assumed we were going to have to do that, because you couldn't fucking stick an Intel chip in that. You know, even the most ignorant of hardware knew that.
Right.
So, and nobody balked. Nobody, you know, it's like, oh, this is going to be too hard. Well, it's like, oh, yeah.
Well, it says a lot about the faith in the OS team and their framework team that they can make it work, right?
Yeah, well, yeah. And to his credit, you know, I mean, I know that Tony Fadell is getting bashed a lot in the press these days, but very early on when we were working on the Purple software stack and what would become iPhone OS, Tony put together a series of meetings where we would talk about, you know, what are the things that we learned or what are the things that Tony's org learned from the iPod, and how are we going to apply them to iPhone. You know, and you know, now, you know, we hear, you know, Tony is kind of famous for, you know, well, I mean, you know, it's all sort of, there's all this lore about, you know, Tony versus Scott, and you know, Tony wanted to hold on to iPod, and he certainly did. I mean, there were other things that demonstrated that he wanted to ship a phone type of thing out of his organization, but to his credit, he was willing to actually share a lot of information about what makes it great, what has made the iPod successful, and what are the things that we really need to look out for. And a lot of that information was just absolutely surprising, and it was not something that we would have been able to figure out, you know, without years of hard fought knowledge ourselves. So
that's great. That speaks really well to the culture of Apple to be able to not put itself into silos and to sort of embrace right. the good of the company rather than the good of the unit.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, and certainly the good of the unit. To be clear, there was still yeah. a lot of that too. But yeah. but absolutely, there was sharing that.
Oh yeah, plays. And that happened. That kind of thing happened a lot in macro and micro detail. Many times I've been in rooms like people coming in and sharing their expertise and teams have been very, very good about. Not just accepting the input, you know, is never really forced on them, but also asking like, Hey, does anybody know anything about this? Like who the hell around here, you know, might have some domain knowledge or experience, and even marshaling people who had experience at other companies to go in and, you know, give a talk about some things that they learned that they could say, you know, despite, you know, around other disclosure issues, certainly, but hey, I've got experience in this. Let me share this thing. Is this useful? Apple's always been really, really good about that kind of thing. And, you know, there was no, it's funny, there was no mandate to do that. There was no, this is in our employee handbook. It was right. just self-evident that that's the way you should do things. That's what I mean. It's only thinking about this now after the fact, like, oh yeah, we did all that and that was really smart. And it's like, but we weren't thinking, well, this is the smart thing to do. You know, we were just trying to figure out how to solve the problem, right?
It's a cultural right. imperative more than a decree.
Yeah, yeah. It's... there were problems that happened because of the functional silos, certainly, where you would have not the right and the left hand not knowing what they were doing in terms of like always inside the software organization, but you would sometimes have somebody in hardware knowing something and not like hiding it from software. It was like we just, you know, we had so many secret things. It was like, oh shit, you guys knew that? We, you know, that that happened after the fact a few times too, right? And it was yeah. and with the growing secret silos inside of software, that also happened with inside of the software organization, which is something that I complained about a lot. And you know, we did it to ourselves, that kind of stupidity. But it wasn't like, it was never like, oh, I have this special knowledge and I'm going to hide it to you. It's like, we can't talk about this project right now. And the inadvertent side effect is, oops, mm-hmm. You didn't know about this cool thing. But it was never ever malicious or done for power struggle reasons or anything else.
No, I think basically, that's a different discussion about like
right.
how Apple maybe trips over its own feet sometimes with that attitude.
Yeah. Part of it goes to the, you know, the well grounded paranoia that Steve had about that kind of thing after. You know, Apple was basically eating its own children, you know, its own profits from all the information leaks and stuff when he came back to the company.
Yeah, they were, you like know, that's, wearing the Osborne effect like a sweater at that point.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's where all that comes from. The yeah. problem was it became the wrong kind of religion to have. And the good thing is they, you know, they're easing up on the hammer, as it were, on that more and more as time goes on. But it's not like they're ever going to live in a glass house. I mean, let's be serious. Right. They're not going to do that either.
Right.
So I guess to – sorry, Needham, did you want to
no.
add something?
No. Go ahead, please.
I guess to sum up, big ship, but
– Big ship or both, big shit?
Well, I'm just trying not to be crude.
Enterprise
look,
class.
I mean, a company of Apple size is a big ship. And it seems to me that you've both seen a number of changes through your careers, and you seem confident that Apple is still in a position to be able to address change and turn relatively quickly.
Yeah, that's
absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that Apple still, you know, I think as long as there are still, you know, the large number of people who were there when I was last there, there's this underlying humility that people have and sort of an understanding that, okay, maybe this AI thing or maybe this machine learning thing really is the next hotness, you know, and so people aren't going to dismiss it outright.
Yeah.
Because of that, you know, and I don't think that they're ever, you know, Apple's ever going to be in a position where they, you know, like I was saying, a hardware company might dismiss, you know, the efforts that it takes to develop a great piece of software. I think that, you know, that humility is going to, and that drive to always want to create the best possible products, you know, I think those two combined are, you know, make me comfortable that, you know, in the face of these new developments by other companies and these new, you know, emphasis, you know, this new emphasis by Google or by these other companies, that, you know, that Apple is going to be able to withstand them and respond in an appropriate way if and when they need to, just because there is that humility.
There's something super interesting about this stuff too, in that the iPhone was a result of a confluence, like we said, of many different things. It was, you know, the components became small enough, the technology became advanced enough, wireless was on the rise. There was the sense that people were about to shift to something new, and Apple happened to be there with a really great product. And AI and ML is just one thing. It's not a confluence of several things, which is what you usually need to start something new. Even looking at Tesla, you know, there's battery technology, and there's concern about the environment, and there's an improvement in autonomous driving, and all these things are coming together to sort of Tesla's benefit right now. But it's not just one thing. And I think that's the sort of thing we're going to look for going forward. It's not just AI, ML, but it's how that works with a bunch of other things, and then who can be there with a killer product to take advantage of it.
Right. Yeah, and if there's a company poised to know how to make killer products, it's going to be the fruit company.
BlackBerry. I mean, right?
Yeah, BlackBerry. They're coming back, I tell you. Coming back.
Sorry, guy, I stepped on you there.
Yeah. I don't know if it's always going to be Apple, because I'm not sure if this is the kind of product that they always do, but I have a lot of faith. And if one thing I want to agree with...
absolutely only be them. I mean, I think that they can do a product in that space. That's what I meant. Sorry.
Yeah. One thing I want to agree with that Neaton said is that I think a lot of these companies, a lot of organizations get taken down by hubris, and while Apple is often portrayed as arrogant, if you talk to the people who work there, there is a lot of humility. I don't know anybody quite as critical of their own work as people who work at Apple. And
yeah.
I think fairly so. Like, these people really want to do the best possible work.
And just like I have my own personal reservations about dismissing machine learning or AI outright, because, you know, that makes me feel like, you know, one of these curmudgeonly hardware people who's just dismissing software development. You're right. but I have to believe that there are people within Apple who are thinking exactly the same way that I am.
Right.
Right. That this is maybe we don't dismiss it outright. Maybe we need to do maybe we need to do a lot more learning about this. And thinking really hard about how we can actually make our products really great by utilizing some of these technologies, and we're not just gonna, you know, just let somebody else out there eat our lunch.
I have to
believe that, because I have those thoughts right now on the outside, that there are still people on the inside who are thinking the same way.
Well, and I'm sure there are. I mean, we still know an incredible shitload of them, and they're in positions of power. The other thing to keep in mind is that there are other technologies and markets that we're not even talking about here, outside of machine learning and AI, that Apple is sweating over right now too.
Yeah, I didn't even want to talk about Apple machine language machine learning or AI necessarily. I wanted to talk about moving a big ship. So thanks for hijacking that big ship. But
so you sure moved it.
But no, I think you're right. I mean, if we, you know, expand it to a meta level, there, or like a greater level, there are a lot of challenges ahead, right. and reorienting the company or any company is always a difficult and non-obvious task, right?
Right, but Apple's problems are not any different than, say, the problems that Google or Amazon or any other large company has. In other words, there's not anything self-evident in the way Apple works that means they can't turn the ship anymore.
I just think that there is a narrative device carried over from the late 90s when they really were on the rocks that Apple could at any moment explode, which is silly, yeah. But it's...
Right. But
it's
in
like
reality,
part of the cultural narrative now, like they, you know, they are the underdog, and therefore, even with
that narrative going
bajillion
on
dollars in the bank, you know,
yeah, that narrative has been going a lot longer than the late 90s. That is, in fact, the narrative about Apple as far back as I can remember.
True. Yeah.
Yeah. And so
maybe it's cultivated.
Honestly, it's
seems
not
to kind of work in their position in their favor.
Cupertino, this is not something, you know. Phil does not stay up at nights thinking, "How can we keep
our brand?" Looks like it's going out of business.
Yeah, right. It's like Jesus H. Christ. This is the way groupthink and.
I don't know what it is.
You know,
but
the people here excluded, but you know, the other shitty media out there operate. And you know, this is not only true of Apple. This is true of other organizations, and just people on a personal level that have high visibility in the world. I mean, I think, and I make some jokes about them. I think Microsoft has this cross to bear too. For some of both their success and their pretty boneheaded mistakes, and nobody.
Yeah, and to be, I think holding high profile organizations under more scrutiny is worthwhile. I don't think there's any problem with that.
Yeah, but if we would just do it with the government instead of,
well, we do. We do. That's why everybody thinks the government sucks.
Yeah. Well, it's the right parts of the government. But
yeah,
we'll get to that in another talk.
Yeah, get another bottle of wine.
Or
for
not.
That.
Yeah, well, I'm going to need a lot of wine for that.
Okay, I actually have to go to dinner. So,
you done with us?
I think this makes
what,
this. Well, I think
what,
it makes it
what
a better
is
show. We're going to start ranting about the government. It's time to go.
I'll fix this in post. It'll be a good, tight 7-minute episode.
Perfect.
Yes. Guy, if people want to find you on the world wild web, where can they go?
At GT on Twitter and occasionally at kickingbear.com. And I have an app called Napkin in the Mac App Store.
Awesome. What about you, Nitin?
I'm at Nitin Ganatra on Twitter, and that's about it.
You could help Don with his transcoding project if you've got time.
Ooh, I could. Ooh. Well, I'd have to learn Ruby, right?
Don, what about you? Where are you?
That doesn't stop anybody else, Nitin. Well, as usual, Don Melton on Twitter. DonMelton.com, my website that I never seem to write at. Don Melton on GitHub. And if you're a language geek, come and follow me on Don Melton on Duolingo, because I'm burning that place up right now.
Nice. You can find me at Rene Ritchie. You can find the show at Debugcast. And thank you all. You guys rock.